Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, ESPN Investigates. Season 2 of the ESPN Investigates podcast is now available. The Running Man tells the story of an obscure former Olympian and alleged serial sexual predator and how a 14-month ESPN investigation brought him out the shadows. More than 50 men were physically abused and mentally manipulated by their coach over 40 years until they banded together decades later to find justice. Be sure to check it out. You can download or subscribe to ESPN Investigates now, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Joining us this week, you know, this is when we have a guest on. You can check her out on SportsCenter. You can catch her on Highly Questionable. Catch her on A Little Round the Horn. She is everywhere. Elle Duncan, what's going on?
What's up, homie? You know, I'm doing good, all things considered. I'm about 11 months pregnant, just trying to make my way to getting this baby out, which undoubtedly will make my life even more awful. So I'm got very mixed feelings. ready to not be pregnant, not ready for two.
Yeah, what, the little homie's coming? Is it December? The little homie's coming
around?
Yeah,
December. Yep. About 7 weeks from now.
Yeah, nah, you wound up in a situation I wonder how many people would accidentally wind up in, which is pandemic pregnant.
Yes. I'm having a coronial. I'm basic in that way. We had sort of, this is going to sound even more midlife crisis for someone in their late 30s that already has a child, but we were actually going to go to Coachella this year. And then after Coachella, we were going to have, you know, once you get all the Coachella alcohol out of your system, we were then going to try to have a kid. But since Coachella got canceled, we were like, oh, might as well try for a second. So that's where we're at.
No, like, serious question on that, though. Like, how, I mean, you've been pregnant before, so you have a basis of comparison, but I've wondered, like, what the difficulty is, given, like, regular people have to take all these precautions to try to make sure that they wind up okay. I imagine it comes to a whole different level when you got to worry about, you know, the bun in the oven.
Yeah, and it's, like, so weird, Bo, because it's stuff that you don't think about, right? Like, everyone knows, right? You can't do drugs or drink alcohol when you're pregnant, right? Like, you can't do any of this. But there's, like, stuff that you don't even realize. You can't have deli sandwiches.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, because of the very small chance that you could get listeria, which is something that no one gets. But if you get it when you're pregnant, you're already like immunosuppressed. So it can cause problems for you. You can't have like certain soft cheeses. I have to like be that girl at the restaurant and be like, hi, is your cheese pasteurized? I mean, there's stuff that you didn't know. You can't have like those naked green juices that you just sort of buy at Whole Foods. You can't eat that kind of stuff. So for me, it's more the first time around was sort of figuring out what I had to be, you know, restrictive about. And then obviously this time, you know, it's that. And also avoiding getting coronavirus. So that's been a whole other layer.
Now, I saw a funny picture you put up on Instagram. I think it was your husband's pictures that he took of your photo shoot. And it was one of you holding your daughter. And I was looking at her and I was thinking, oh, man, wait till she finds out that's competition in there.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She doesn't fully grasp, like she'll say baby brother and we already have a name for him. So she'll, you know, say his name. But right now it's still all well and good because he's like in mommy's belly. Once she has to compete for lap time, when she has to compete for food or attention, I don't think it's going to go well, like to the point where it's not that I think my daughter is like Damien from The Omen or anything, but I've told my husband Omar a couple of times, like, you do know we can't like leave her alone in the same room with the baby. I've seen how she treats her dolls. I don't want her to suffocate the baby like she does Elmo. So we've reached sort of that point as well, where we're like, she could be a danger and a threat to our child.
One of my favorite baby stories, my buddy Shannon, when his wife was pregnant with his daughter, his son, I think he's 3 years older than her. And I'd be over there and they had like a picture of the sonogram, you know, yeah. And little man be like, sister, like he was all about it. Baby was born. They brought him in the hospital room. He looked at the baby. He pointed at her and said, I don't want that. Like, I mean, they think it's thieves. You know, it didn't take long after that before it all got good. But he loved the idea of a sibling in theory. Once it hit application, he was like, yo, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So my sister is like 5.5, 6 years older than me. She didn't mind having a sibling, but this was back in the day where they used to have proper nurseries, right? And like all the babies would be in there. So they take my sister to the nursery and they're like, look, Kelly, there's your little sister. And she says, I don't want that one. I want the brown one right there. So she was trying to hand select a little brown baby. She did not want this little light-skinned baby. She just wanted a brown one.
Yo, I had never thought of the idea that a kid could go into the nursery and be like, oh, so we just get to pick one?
Yes, great. That's what she thought. She thought that you get to go select a baby, and she wanted the chocolate baby. She didn't want the drowned rat light-skinned baby, so...
Damn, man. Well, congratulations. I look forward to seeing the little homie. This will be an interesting one. You guys are fun. So, like, therefore, I feel like fun people have fun children. I'm here for fun children.
Yeah, I'm into it. She's my daughter's crazy, as you know, and still loves you. Sees us on HQ, stares at you. She's into it.
I know, pandemic is messed up. She and I were establishing a cool little bond situation, and then we couldn't go outside no more.
No, couldn't come to New York anymore. So it's over. She's moved on.
Yeah. It happens.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, you are from Atlanta. Well, you're from Atlanta-ish. I think we can kind of...
Atlanta adjacent.
Yeah. Like that, you know, once we start talking about COBB, you know, it kind of depends on what streets y'all do, on what level of Atlanta we give you. And I tell people, I understand if you don't know anything about Atlanta, how this won't mean anything to you. But one of my favorite things in the evolution of Atlanta is Cumberland Mall turning into a Black People Mall, which is nothing that anybody ever could have seen coming. Like, wherever you are from, you were thinking to yourself, I've never been to a Black Apple store before. Come to Cumberland Mall.
Go to Cumberland. Cumberland will fulfill all of your needs for Blackishness. In fact, when they built, do you remember their counter for how Black Cumberland had gotten was they built the Cobb Galleria. And that was supposed to be like the fancy mall with like boutique stores that we couldn't afford. And then we took that over as well. Well, it's never been the same.
No, that's the thing about Atlanta. You can't put anything anywhere near the perimeter and think that once somebody heard that it was dope, we showing up. And then once we show up, they are not.
Yeah. Once we understand that there's more out there than Greenbrier, there's more out there than Lids.
Yes. Yeah, then we there. And then once the white folks find out that we are there, suddenly they got to go find a new one. Yes. No matter what it is, it don't matter how far out they got to go. Yeah. Once we are there, like, Cumberland, I would love to know. Like, I don't feel like it was a gradual change in Cumberland going from being a white people mall to being a Black people mall. I don't know where the trip over was, but at some point, white folks rolled up and was like, nope. We got to go find us a new one. They got one in
Town
Kennesaw.
Town Center Mall in Kennesaw. You just got to keep going up 75, homie.
Yo, every time I go, like, whenever I be in town and I have to do something on 75, it is like year after year, you go farther and farther and farther out 75. The line has been pushed farther and farther and farther out.
Oh, yeah. They live in Canton now, which is damn near Tennessee. Yeah, because that's where they've got to go now to get away from us. They just got to keep going.
We're at the point now where they move to places that I've never heard of. Look, when the Migos came out and I realized that that was what Gwinnett County was talking about at this point, that's when I was like, oh, wow. Had no idea, because why would I ever go there?
Bo, I did the same thing. Like, when I found out, you know, it's like, okay, there's Migos and like we like Migos and all that. And they, same thing. They say Atlanta. Then you do some digging and you're like, okay, Gwinnett, but they do have some spots in Gwinnett. But then I found out Quavo went to Berkmar, and like the Berkmar that I knew was not a Berkmar where they'd be talking about the street. So I was like, I was so confused, because I was like, this is not just Gwinnett, this is Lawrenceville. Like, that is so different than what I knew of Lawrenceville to be.
Well, one thing I do like about them is they admit, we didn't have to be like this. Like, this is something we chose, right? They are not victims of circumstance. They were mischievous children who decided to take it in such a direction. But I remember the first time I met an actual real ass gangster from Gwinnett. Yeah. It was the most shocking thing in the world, because like I'm looking at him like, I know real when I see real. Yeah. He was absolutely real. And he was talking to me about Gwinnett. I'm like, Gwinnett? He's like, man, Gwinnett real out here. And I was not in a position to question this man's realness, as he had his name in the front four teeth.
Oh, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Not his government name, but the name that he went by. I have no, I have no idea what his government name is. Yeah. I just remember that he had to stop hanging out with one of his frat brothers. We're like, why? Like, cause he the feds. And I understand why he said the dude was the feds, because you'd ask him like, else, where do you work? I work for the government. That's all he say is I work for the government. But he was going overseas on his work for the government. He was not worried about the sorts of things that this other gentleman perhaps would be engaged in. The purviews were not overlapping. But I was looking at him like, I had no idea that Gwinnett County had anything like this. In fact, it seems to me to defeat the purpose of going to Gwinnett County.
Yeah, well, you know, as you know, there's like hamlets. Like, it's almost like there's little hamlets of sort of the hood all over Atlanta because, well, no one wants to fight that traffic. So they're like, well, we'll just meet the hood where it's at. And where it's at in Gwinnett is where we're going to stay. But yeah, I love that my husband is from East Point, Georgia, you know, home of Outkast and like the home of Adam Jones, went to middle school with Pac-Man, has stories. But same thing, he worked for the government, but as an engineer, and he's like, yo, it's like automatically, as soon as you say you work for the government, people think you're the DEA. I'm like, there's so many other jobs.
Right. Like all the government is a police force.
Correct. One giant police force.
It's funny you mentioned that with Pac-Man. Like, one of my favorite Atlanta games is, do you have a Pac-Man story?
Yes.
Right. Very few of them are like appropriate to bring out in public. Right. Because they might be true. They might not. But if they're not true, somebody's going to get sued. Because there is no just like regular, normal Pac-Man story. They're all off the chain.
Yes, I do have one. I'll leave out some of the details, but put it this way. Pac-Man was participating in a charity football game and was not happy with one of the celebrations that someone on another team levied at him, you know, a nice butt tap, and threatened his life and shut the entire charity football game down.
Yes. And the thing you have to remember, and you know this, like, it's obvious, but it's still something worth remembering. It's not like he's Suge Knight. Pac-Man's like 5'11", like 185, 190. He's not some giant dude. He's got a lot of want to.
Yeah. But that's the thing is that, you know, there are thinly veiled threats, right? And like, there's bravado and men will say things, and like, you've seen it, Bo. But when it comes to Pac-Man, people know his reputation to the point where even something that normally you would sort of take as like a benign, like, oh, men being men, machismo threat, literally everyone was like, run for your car!
Yeah. Coming. Yeah, no, that's not a bad. There's something about a vibe when everybody's like, oh, no, it's time to go. Like, it's hard to explain. Even if you're wrong about it, where you're somewhere and you catch a whiff of something in the air and you're just like, yo, we got to bounce.
I love that you mentioned that, because I do think that among all of the magical qualities that Black people have, I'm a firm believer that we can smell violence. Like, we can smell it coming, and it's just like the air changes and all of a sudden we recognize it and we try to get the hell out of there.
Yes. Well, you never know, right? Like, I tell this story when I was in college. The California Club would have a picnic every year and it would be a giant thing, right? Because like, when you go to school at the Atlanta University Center, you got all kinds of people from everywhere, and people love doing nothing more than they love putting on for the crib, right? Like, that's just that nobody loves anything more than college than putting on for the hometown. And so the California Club has their picnic, and we get out there, and it looks like a giant version of the G-Thang video, right? Like, you just got people smoking weed everywhere, people drinking 40s, you know, cars just back, like, there's no like solid music there. Everybody's got music playing from whatever it is. Like, I was 17 years old. I'd never seen people smoking that much weed before in my life. Like, I just didn't know what it was. But we standing out there, and I remember at some point, some dude had the California flag wrapped around his shoulders. And again, I'm from Texas, but I had just never in my life imagined that I would go get me a Texas flag so that I could just represent everywhere that I go, right? Now, don't get me wrong. In Texas, white folks is all good for that.
Sure.
But I, like, you know, I ain't never think about doing that. No, they love California. He got a California flag wrapped around. And I don't know who he was fighting and why, but it wasn't going well for him, because some dude jumped off a car and hit him in the head with a 40 bottle. It was all bad news. And then a few minutes later, I hear the baka, 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 and everybody hits the ground and then looks around, and then everybody got up, and then the party started again. And I was like, nah, we out.
We got to go.
We out, because let me tell you, whoever had that gun, it didn't sound like they did what they wanted to do.
Right.
It just sounds like they bucks. No, we got to go. And my man, he was from some hard scrabble D.C., and he got in the car with me. He was like, I guess this don't happen in Houston at parties. I'm like, yeah, dude, and I'm down to go home when that happens also, like there's always somebody down to tough it out. I'm like, it wasn't that cracking out there.
No. And it's Atlanta. There's always another, especially where you were at the AU Center. Like, I have to ask you, because sort of when I was old enough to really work my way down into the city from Powder Springs, Georgia, Morris Brown was shutting down. And I always hear these like sort of stories about like how, you know, you go to Spelman and Morehouse, you want to hang out with the Clark kids. But then like the Clark kids, there was a time where they wanted to hang out with the Morris Brown kids. Like what, how much of that sort of came into play with Morris Brown, or did it not at all?
So Morris Brown was interesting in that there are two very significant factors about who goes to Morris Brown.
Okay.
One, Morris Brown's the only school of all those in the Atlanta University Center that was actually founded by Black people. Mm-hmm. And it was the only school that was like open enrollment. Like if you wanted to go to college and you had a high school diploma, you could go to Morris Brown.
Yep.
So you got that range of people that is allowed by the fact that the low end is broader. But on top of it, it's AME school. And so the kids of AME preachers, that's where they send their kids is to Morris Brown. So like that's the mix of people that you had. The thing about going to Morris Brown, though, was you kind of needed to make that walk in today, because they are on the other side of MLK.
Yep.
And it could get kind of real making your trips over to Morris Brown. Like that was the thing, going to school in the center when I did, because I was there from 97 to 01. So one, it was the best time in the world to be in Atlanta, because Atlanta was blowing up. Like they'd been the slow burn up to that point. They'd been the Freaknicks in 94 and 95. And then 97, like 97 was when the first Lil Jon album came out, right? Not one that y'all heard of, like the one with Who You With, Get Crunk, Who You With. Like it's that level of Lil Jon. So we're there in the beginning of all of that stuff. And this is when, and now all the cats from the East Coast are starting to come down and try to get their music thing on. Like I tell people, like Don Cannon came into school with me, for example. And I remember when Don.
Cannon.
Yeah, exactly. I remember when Don would only play records out of New York, even though he was from Philly. You know, and then Don had the evolution that comes from being in Atlanta, you know, that whole time. But like, if you were trying to get some music stuff on, like I went to school with so many people that were doing this into the industry, that in the industry, not because they had some end before they got there. Like this was just a hustle. One dude came down. I forget where he transferred from. But the second he got there, he was like, oh, yeah. And every week I'm doing a comedy show. We got the auditorium at Haven Warren for the comedy show. And when I talk about comedy show, I mean, like Jay Smooth.
Oh, wow.
Doing the shows. Yeah, like a whole lot of cats that wound up being somebody that we didn't know. Like, it was the most interesting time in the world to be in a city. And, like, you Black and you come to Atlanta, you ain't never seen nothing like this before. But Black people of all types are everywhere doing all things. Like, even if you're from a city that has a lot of Black people, not like it was in Atlanta at that time. Like, that was nothing in my life goes the way it does if I wasn't there then. Like, I know that specifically.
Yeah. It's like the heyday. Because I graduated from high school in 01 and didn't really work my way down to Atlanta until probably like 05 is when I sort of moved downtown and started doing radio and was really like, you know, in the culture. And I always would hear tales of, you know, the old Velvet Room and camp and like all the stuff that would happen at the AU Center.
Yeah, but see, you got there for a different time, because 05, that's BMF era Atlanta.
Correct.
Yeah, and that is something I actually don't know anything about, because I wasn't around for, you know, for that period of time. But the BMF era stories about Atlanta are, so this really blew up. Gosh, yeah.
It was so bananas, like, because I was working in the radio at the time, so I'd work these clubs, and, you know, they'd be like, you know, BMF's coming through, like they have the entire section. Don't let anyone that you would hear these sort of stories. Like I remember hearing a story about how there was, I won't give too many details, but it was a very popular nightclub. There was, because you know how Atlanta is, it's very segregated in terms of like, Black, same club, right? Black night on Friday, white night on Saturday, Asian night Sunday, like whatever, even down to Asian night.
Right.
Well, the Asians had decided, because there was an incredibly popular hip hop artist that was going to be sort of at the club that night, the group of Asian gentlemen decided they wanted to buy the table next to them. And the table was normally like a $5,000 or $6,000 table. They paid $25,000 to sit next to this very, very popular artist who has gone through multiple name changes. the remix god. I'll leave it there. And BMF had come through, and that had been their normal table. Even though they never said that they were going to come that night, they showed up. They were not happy with the Asians getting their table, offered to match the money. But the club owner was like, no, like I gave this table to these people. There was an altercation that led to the Asian group wanting to leave, some of them on a stretcher, and then BMF was able to move in for free. So it would definitely go down where you really did have to sort of tiptoe around like where you were standing, what you were doing, and you didn't want to get caught up in, and you know, God forbid you like draw the attraction or attention of them. And it was a really nuts time, you know, for that particular like junction in Atlanta, just sort of, or even just sometimes wrongly accusing people of being part of it, right? Like if someone pulled up to the valet and they had a Phantom, you're automatically like, oh, that's got to be BMF. I'm sure they've got 500 compartments in that car. But it was nuts.
Yo, a dope crew had the billboard downtown that you saw coming off 85 from the airport to let you know that you were in town.
Yes.
A billboard.
Yep.
It's the most reckless thing I've ever, like, y'all know y'all sell dope, right?
Yes. Yeah. They felt like incredibly untouchable. And I know there's a million documentaries on it and whatnot, but they did. I mean, they had, you know, artists like Jeezy who were super popular at the time, like normalizing everything that they did. And it was like, they just didn't care. I mean, it was, they had record labels. They were really a part of the fabric of Black culture in Atlanta. They would be, you know, we certainly accepted some BF money for charity events at certain things because that's sort of, they had become so mainstream that it was very normal to sort of exist in a world where you would collaborate with them for particular things. And if you think about it, it's obviously quite bananas, but like, that's really where we were at as a city.
Yo, and they weren't even from there.
Yeah.
Like normally interlopers don't get to come kick it like this. No, they ran the whole thing. Like I remember like the progression from like 01 to 03 to 05 because I left in 01 to go to graduate school in California. And I remember I came back in 03 and I went to, I think it was Fuel. Fuel was over there in Buckhead. Yeah. I think that was the one. It was one of those. And we in there. And again, I ain't been around for a while. You know, things flip up. And it was the first time that I had ever heard head busses because it came on in the club. And I look around, okay? And just to let you know, like, what kind of crew was there that night, I went there with my homeboy who back in the day we used to call Crazy, and he has Crazy tattooed on his forearm, and my mama calls him Crazy like it's his name. And his girl was with him, and she showed up in a leather, like, I don't even want to call it overalls. It was like patent leather, red, like, straps come down, you know, one, like, one piece sort of joint, like, you know, this is who was at the spot that night, you know, like we there and head busses come on. And all I hear is this. And I look up and it's just a club full of people putting their fist into their hands. But if nobody told you this is about to happen, I'm in there like, yo, ho, 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 ho. Like, is this about the song? Is something, you know, because I have not heard the words head busses yet. Yes. All I see is a bunch of people preparing for a fight. And even as somebody who was there through 3-6 and No Limit and all that fight music, this felt like something different. And yeah. I gradually figured out I wasn't supposed to leave. Then 05 comes and it's like, oh, okay, so this is, we're just in a whole nother world now.
Oh, yeah. 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 That was around the time. I love that you brought up head bus. With some head bus.
Yes.
Yeah, that's our original, like, knuck a few buck. It was right around the time too, Bo, when they would start telling the DJs, like, please don't play violence music until at least the very end, or they would try to get the DJ set ahead of time. And if they were going to play that, this is for real. If they were going to play some of like what they would consider the violence set, then they would prepare the bartenders that at a certain time, like, this is going to be the song that's going to key you. And at that time, lock up the Hennessy. Legit, they like, or at least tell them it's sold out. So they would try to prevent, because we all know, like, the Hennessy drunk is a whole other kind of drunk, right? Like, the anger within you from the Hennessy is different. It's a totally different level. So they would, like, it was a very coordinated effort to try to combat some of the violence that they would see in people just getting really riled up with this music by at the very least trying to eliminate the Hennessy out of the picture. It was nuts.
Like, I remember when Teta Club Up came out, and I was trying to explain to my brother about Teta Club Up because he was in New Jersey at the time. So, you know, he can't get no grasp of that. My brother's 13 years older than me. It's worth noting. I'm telling him about Teta Club Up. And I'll never forget what he said is, if it was my establishment, I would be trying to play the remix called Tear Your Old Up, right? Like, just like, when you really stop and think about the concept of the idea that we're going to play 8 songs in a row that are about beating each other up. Mm-hmm. This is not a wise move for you to make. Them joints was jamming, but this is not a wise move for you to make.
No, I think the best thing that happened to the clubs was the snap music era.
Yes.
Because it was just, everybody was just, you know, bouncing. Like, nobody was trying to bust heads because it was a whole thing. Like, there was a whole, like, Soulja Boy and swag surfing that was fun and coordinated and didn't lead to literally people ripping your place apart.
I actually remember I came to Atlanta in 05 because I was doing some work for ESPN at the time, and I went to the step show, Morehouse's Homecoming. And again, I've been gone for a while. I've heard, like, Laffy Taffy in these songs because they've made it where they are, but I've not been in establishments where they come on. And next thing I know, they play one of them. And I look around, I ain't never felt so old in my life. And I was 25 years old. All of a sudden, they all, ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm like, what in the world are you doing? Like, I was like, what is this? Yeah. Like, why are we snapping our fingers? This all seems bizarre. And then Kryptonite came on and it got a reaction that I was more accustomed to. And I was like, okay, ain't everything changed?
Yeah.
But I was like, what is this? I can't leave Atlanta and come back. Like, you leave for 9 months, you come back, and I don't understand what's going on here anymore.
Well, you're forever changed the first time you see someone do the Fabo. You see a grown man, you know, reach up and grab his, you know, his ankle and hit like a scorpion pose. You're like, what in the hell is going on? And he, you know, Brothers was doing that. It was,
and
like,
he still might shoot you. Like that's kind of the, like, it was almost like a take back to the 1970s. Like, don't let the Isley Brothers fool you. Just because they out here wearing them get-ups don't mean they won't take this outside. And that is basically what snap dancing brought back, is it brought back the don't let the smooth taste fool you element that had been gone for a while. Because the gangsters were very apparent for about a good 15 years. The gangsters were making it clear to you that they were the gangsters. Now, the gangsters might be out here snapping their fingers.
Correct. But still gangsta. So don't poke the sleeping giant.
No. You don't want no parts of that. Wow, we wound up with like 25 minutes of random Atlanta talk. But the thing about random Atlanta talk is, I feel like you don't even have to be from Atlanta to jump on and appreciate what this madness is that we are describing.
Yeah. Atlanta influences everything. And I feel like, yes, you don't have to be from there to sort of understand, like, why you see those shirts that say, you know, old Atlanta over new Atlanta, and like, what, because I think at this point, most people have spent some time in Atlanta. It's sort of like the black Mecca. I had a friend the other day tell me, they're like, I randomly had a cousin just quit her job and move to Atlanta without a job, without prospects, without a place to live. Like, it's become this place where it's like, you know, black people just go there, you know, bring us your poor, you're tired, you're hungry, you're black. We'll take care of you here.
Yo, when I worked at the Gap at Lenox when I was in college, and I'll never forget, I met this dude. He was just, you know, coming into the store or whatever. And I forget where he said he was from. Basically, he said 2 weeks prior, he had come to Atlanta for something. But I don't think he was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. And he wasn't leaving. Like, if he was, and he said that if he was leaving, he was just going to go pack up his stuff and then come back. And please understand that this dude was married, right? He had just made the call. Like, he got there and was like, yep, I'm not leaving.
This me.
And he's not the only person that you encounter who just has this, where they get to Atlanta and they're just like, yeah, okay, cool, I'm gonna stay here.
Yeah. You said it best, though, Bo. I think it's because, like, I have friends from D.C., and they're like, oh, that's the original Chocolate City. There's hella black people there. We get tired of people saying, you know, Atlanta's the black capital of the world. But to your point, it's not that there's just black people there. It's that there are black people at every level there, you know, doing everything. Like, I lived in Boston, and the only black people I would see at times were, like, service workers, or, you know what I mean? And then you go to Atlanta, and you've got... We run the entire gamut, from CEOs to service workers to police officers. I mean, you spend time in Atlanta, you might never see a white cop. Like, it's so, I think that's what's so the draw for people, is especially people who have sort of come from these cities where they are the minority, is it is very different to go to a place where you're the majority, and the majority is doing everything at every single level. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you know my buddy, Spencer Hall, a college football writer, but Spencer's one of my very good friends. And this is about 5 or 6 years ago. We went and caught up at you'll know the bar I'm talking about. It's kind of got this old school is not the way to put it. It's right by MJQ. Okay. Right, like right over there on Ponce. Like I'm trying to describe. It's like you go in. It's like the wood paneling on the walls everywhere. Like it's that kind of spot. And so I'm there with Spencer, and we're just hanging out. And I look at him, and I realize it had dawned on me. I got to Atlanta in 1997 for college. My parents have lived there since then, so I've been consistently in Atlanta now almost 20 years at the time of this story. And it hits me. This is the first time I've ever hung out with a white person in Atlanta on purpose. And I'm not a person that doesn't hang out with white people. You know what I mean? Atlanta is just that segregated. Yeah. That I had never incidentally made a white friend in town.
Yeah.
And then we go kick it somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I remember this is probably like 12 years ago when I was there and I was still working clubs. They made this big deal, Bo, out of doing like a unity weekend. The white radio station, the black radio station got together. And as a unit, like they promoted it and everything. They're like, tonight at Visions, we're all going to party together. And it was like this huge, like they wrote about it in the newspaper because it's like everyone sort of like did their own thing. You know, you don't go there on white night, or you do, and you know that you're going to probably hear a lot of EDM.
Right.
And you know what I mean? Or you don't go on Asian night. You know, some of the most popular spots literally have a white night, a black night, and an Asian night. And so it is like it's sort of just accepted. And I hate that. Like it would be nice. Obviously there's some trickle over. Right. But I did hate that. Like I hated that. It was very much like even promoted that way, you know, hip hop night.
Right.
But that's sort of like accepted there. And it always sort of has been. And the idea that, which is so weird to me, because as you know, I mean, like white people love hip hop more than I think black people do. So this idea that they would need to feel comfortable in their own white space, but listening to the same damn music with the exception of an EDM circuit, just always seemed so crazy to me. And I've asked, because haven't lived in Atlanta now for 6-7 years. And I ask friends, I'm like, is it still that way? Like, is it still segregated? They're like, oh yeah, no, it's still black night, white night. Like we still don't really party together at the same exact spots.
Were you there for the Outkast shows at Centennial Park?
Yes.
When the Garth Brooks show was at Phillips at the same time. So like right across the street, Garth Brooks did a run of like 7 shows at Phillips Arena. And then at the weekend, Outkast did 3 shows at Centennial Park. And there's a curfew. And so the shows are basically letting out at the same time. And it was like the two streams shall not cross. Right. And it's not that there weren't white people at the Outkast shows, because there were. But the people who were leaving one were not like they were coming out the same place. They walked in the same place for their cars. And it was like two North Poles on a magnet. They wasn't getting too close. Like they might, but then they gonna bounce right back.
Yeah. Separate but equal. Which is something we should be saying in 2020, but it's very true.
So you gonna get off this Falcons narcotic?
Bo, I'm not on the Falcons narcotic. I am from Atlanta, but my family's from Denver. And the only team that they have supported their whole life is the Broncos. We're like 60-year season ticket holders in my family. So I support the Falcons because they're the hometown team, but they don't affect me or hurt me. I will tell you, my original team, even before the Broncos, even before, it was the Braves. Like I played baseball growing up, and I remember being 7-8 years old in that 91 World Series. You know, I remember being so pissed off at your boy who ripped Ron Gant's leg off of first base. Like, that's my team. So to say that I don't care about the Falcons.
That's right.
Braves that really bum me out.
Oh,
though.
Yeah. Because, see, I think the thing with me with the Braves is I quit. I could come back to the Braves, but we had to break up. And we had to break up. Because Brian McCann was out here on this play the game the right way stuff. And I just couldn't be on the side of that no more. You know what I'm saying? Like, I looked up at some point and I was like, yo, why? Because you got to remember, them 91 Braves was black as hell. I look up in like 2013, 2014, and it's like all a bunch of dudes from North Atlanta. Like a bunch of white dudes from North Atlanta. And and they out here like acting like it, you know, like telling cats that they can't look at their home runs and making it the whole team mantra. I was like, nah, I can't do that. But at least the Braves have provided happiness for me. Like the Braves are an important part of my childhood in a way that like the Falcons never were. The Hawks never were.
Ever.
Like the Braves mattered. It warms my heart to like talk about them. And so I got out for those reasons. But even when they it got to a point where it's like, okay, we're not going to win another World Series. I was like, think about what I'm just saying. Another, like, we got one, baby.
What?
We good, we straight, and we always good. Like, I was like, okay, cool, I can do this. I'd be looking at them Falcons fans. Like, what have they ever done for you? What have they ever provided in your life? Like, I think you said your husband, he finally had to start backing away, didn't he?
He quit after the Cowboys game. I couldn't believe he stuck around after 28-3. They sent me to Atlanta, ESPN did, because I was supposed to, you know, cover the Atlanta perspective should they win. And so, of course, they do not. And we're in the hotel room. And Bo, it's like a movie. He's like asleep. And he's wrestling around in his sleep. And he's literally just going, run the ball. Why don't you run the ball? And I was like he was in a nightmare. And he woke up sad. And I was like, why do you keep doing that? Like, this is the same team who also had their best year, made it to the Super Bowl, and then had their starting safety arrested the night before for soliciting prostitution.
The man of the year.
Like, that should have been sort of what told you that this, and if not for, I think, Tim Dwight, that would have been a blowout Super Bowl too. So, and they got rid of Michael Vick, and like, what in you is still supporting this team? But he was still supporting the Falcons, albeit cautiously, until the Cowboys. And he was like, you know what? I don't care. I don't want to hear about it. I don't care about their scores. I'm done. I don't want to hear anymore. When were you out?
Oh, when a quarterback went to jail for fighting dogs. What am I like? Why am I sticking around with this? And the thing about when the quarterback went to jail for fighting dogs is, it's not simply that he went to jail for fighting dogs, which was its own like depressing, terrible like situation. But man, that was when Atlanta didn't feel racist to me, because I was just always around black people. Like, I hadn't done the math on the fact that I was always around black people actually being an indicator of the racism. And then the Michael Vick thing happened, and I was like, oh, this is what's going on. Like, I was not one of those people that was really like jumping on the, well, he was just fighting, you know, what's the big deal? It's just some dog. I didn't go to that place. I just looked at the visceral reaction that came in the other direction. And I was like, oh, I don't like any of this. No. I don't want to be no parts of this.
Yeah. Well, and then of course, then they go and they get quite literally like the whitest quarterback possibly in the world that you can get. And Matt Ryan, like, they sort of went from, you know, Mike Vick to Opie. And I think for me, it wasn't just then, Bo, like when Michael Vick, because, you know, I did like, and I sort of knew as well, I was around the Falcons. I had been doing, you know, some sidelining for some of their games. And I had some sort of intel that led me to believe that the Falcons really did try to support Mike Vick, but they very much asked him to be honest with them. Like, tell us the truth. We will protect you. We will work through this. We will. And he just kept lying to them. And so it got to a point where when everything was made public and then, you know, he admitted to doing it, they sort of washed their hands of him. That to me didn't stand out as much, although hindsight tells me yes. It was really the less than microaggressions, the passive aggressions, the aggressions, and how they described Matt Ryan. Yeah. When we took him, that was really made me like sick. I was like, it was, and it wasn't Matt Ryan's fault. I mean, he couldn't help that he's like a white dude.
Yeah, he seemed like a good dude.
He's a nice guy. But it was just the way that they would talk about, you know, everything became about him being the anti-Mike Vick. And I'm like, listen, Mike Vick, it was deplorable and disgusting what he did. But let's also not forget that he rescued your franchise from obscurity. And like that he transformed the game of football, that he sold seats, that he was the biggest name in football for many years. And like for you to just sort of, you know, talk about how, well, he never prepared and like he didn't care and he was a terrible teammate. And like Matt Ryan is intelligent. Matt Ryan's a thinker. He comes from BC. Like, and that to me is what really made me sick about the whole thing, was that it wasn't just that they moved on from Michael Vick or the way that they did, but the way that they just had to drag his name continuously through the mud for years and years and years, asking, you know, sort of asking people not to wear Mike Vick jerseys to the, it just felt like they were trying to erase an entire part of their history and an important part of their history.
The best thing to ever happen to them. Yeah. There's no argument against it, right? Like, Michael Vick is not an NFL Hall of Famer. Like, I say this thing, like, I look at him as what I call, like, a rock and roll Hall of Famer. Like, how Guns N' Roses is a rock and roll Hall of Fame band on the strength of one album. Like, you can't do that in sports, but you can do that in music. And Michael Vick is one of those types. If I'm not mistaken, they have sold out every single game since 2002.
Yeah.
And that is entirely about Michael Vick.
Yes.
Like that's strictly about him. He, you know, he himself made it impossible. And then, of course, everybody had to take it just a little bit. Oh, both sides. Like, Michael Vick is the O.J. Simpson case of Atlanta.
Yes. Yeah, like that's a great way to put it.
That's the best way to put it. Like, it just, it split everything up. And I was like, yeah, nah, I don't need to participate in this. And then I know when I quit the Hawks. I quit the Hawks February 24th, 1994. Traded Dominique Wilkins for Danny Manning. Who does that? Who does that? Like, I'm just, who does that? You know? And plus, they had never been good at nothing, no way. You know what I'm saying? I was just like, yeah, I can get out. I can get out on this.
I quit the Hawks. I worked for them for many years, and I was there. My first season with them was the 12-win season. I think that was Josh Smith's first year. I went to high school with Josh Smith. I quit the Hawks after... or at least I didn't quit them. I just sort of gave up on any hope or promise of them doing anything when we were like two free throws away from making the conference finals and Al Horford missed both free throws. I think on two separate occasions missed like what would have been the game clinching free throws to send it. We eventually ended up losing and didn't make it to the conference finals. And what was probably that last chance after that, they sort of blew the team up. But that's when I was like, man, like we can't, this is just feeling like an Atlanta thing. And this is well before 28-3, but it was just feeling like we were always the city that could get right there and then just never, outside of those, what, 94, 95 Braves, like we were just the city that could never get past that big moment, that could never rely on a clutch moment to carry us through. You know, we never had the benefit of Tom Brady for 20 years. Like you may be down, but you're never out of it so long as you have him. When I was with the Hawks, I was like, you know what? This is just, it's not going to work. They let Larry Drew go, which I understood. Then they bring in Coach Bud. The Hawks, to me, has never been my favorite team. I support them because I worked for them for 8 years. So it doesn't hurt what happens with them, but like where we're at. And then if you weren't, of course, out on them before they decided to trade away Luka Doncic, like where are you at now? Luka. It's not all on Trae Young, but Luka Doncic.
And somebody made the point when they did that. They were like, this trade, for it to work, requires the Hawks to know something that nobody else knows. And when have the Hawks ever known anything that nobody else knew? And that honestly is one of the most, like, that was the most dead ass things I've ever heard in my life that proved to be true. I did not realize, by the way, you went to high school with Josh, and I've tried to imagine Josh Smith as high school superstar, and Josh is cool ass daddy showing up to games.
So Josh was a freshman when I was a senior, and you know, we just knew him as like the young, really good kid who was on varsity and made our team really relevant and good. And then he left to go to Oak Hill Academy, right? Which is where like all of the good basketball players go. You don't really have to go to school. And so he left to go to Oak Hill. But it was funny because right before Josh got drafted, I was working at like a Macy's at Cumberland Mall. I used to work at Cumberland Mall. And I was working at a Macy's there selling perfume. And in walks Josh. And he's like, it's like a round, you know, it's, I don't even remember what it was. But he like walks in and he's like, yeah, you know, I'll take this and I'll take that and I'll take all these bottles of perfume. And I was like, okay. And I knew who he was. I went to high school with him. He didn't know who I was. And I was like, yeah, you spending money. You blowing money fast, Josh. He's like, I'm about to become a Hawk. I was like, oh, are you? He's like, yeah, I'm about to be an Atlanta Hawk. So you know, it's on me. Like, comes through stunting, but like, you know, stunting in a way that an 18-year-old would, right, buying like CK1 and stuff like that, right? Aqua Di Gio. Show me the JPG. And then sure enough, like later that day, he was at his Hawks press conference. But so Josh didn't have like a reputation then that he certainly has now for sort of being Josh Smith. Forever, when I think of Josh Smith, always remember being in Phillips Arena and listening to, I have never in my life, Bo, heard the home crowd collectively and consistently for at least a solid 2 years all scream no when he came up to shoot a three. Everybody, it was like a chant that had become sort of ingrained in the Hawks. You would just hear everyone go, no, because this guy refused to stop shooting three.
My dad's lying about Josh Smith. He sent me a text once. Josh is sorry. talented, but sorry. Like, that's all he had to say. He's talented, but he's sorry. And that was it. That about summed it up.
It's hard to believe that he was one of the last straight to high school players, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And you're right. I just think he never really, he always relied on his God-given ability and never really worked on it beyond that. You know,
yeah.
If Kobe Bryant, 16 years in, could still have his own key to Phillips Arena so that he could get there at 5 o'clock in the morning to work on his shot. I don't understand why Josh Smith felt that he could not, but that was the problem, is that as soon as people started catching up to his ability, it was sort of over for him.
Yeah, well, L. Duncan, I know you got some moves to make. Check her out, SportsCenter, and all over the ESPN dial. Thank you so much.
I love talking Atlanta with you.
All we do is post up, man.
I know, man. It's a win. You're the best. Thanks for having me, Bo.
Now I'm trying to keep up with you. Tell everybody I said what's happening. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.